Hello, welcome to another episode of the Fillory Podcast, where we move backwards on the cycle and reflect on the earlier days of a founder's journey to uncover learnings that you can apply to your business today. I am Brandon Hondoko, and on this episode, I'm very excited to be joined by Terrence Tam, who is the founder at Reflow Hub, a B2B marketplace for the wholesale volume of used mobile devices between vendors and buyers globally. Reflow Hub was also recently named the second fastest growing startup in Australia by the Australian Financial Times, bringing in almost $40 million of revenue in 2019. Prior to Reflow Hub, though, Terrence was the founder at Ross & Zane, a startup that delivered lunch to Australian professionals before the Uber Eats, DoorDash, and Postmates-enabled world that we know today came about. In this episode, Terrence and I discuss his impressive history as the youngest full-time hire at JP Morgan in Australia, marketplaces at the enterprise scale, and what a conventional Australian lunch looks like for folks in corporate. Sit tight, get a notebook ready, and thank you for listening. This podcast wouldn't be possible without the help of our friends over at Referral Hero, the all-in-one platform to design and run flexible referral programs that grow your bottom line. If you're tired of wasting money on Facebook ads or writing tons of content that never rank on Google but already have loyal customers, you should definitely try a referral program. The Dollar Flight Club grew its business by 13%, and Holiday Pirates added 300,000 emails in less than a month after setting up their referral programs. The best thing about all of this is that you can get started in minutes with their no-code widgets, and if you sign up today, you can get 20% off with the code FAILORY20. Try it now for 14 days without any cost at referralhero.com. Once again, that's referralhero.com. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Failory Podcast, your one-stop shop for failed ventures and failed projects, but more importantly, the lessons you can learn from them. I'm your host, Brandon Hondoko, and today I'm very, very excited to have Terrence Tam on the podcast. Hello, Terrence.
Hey, Brandon.
Terrence, you are currently the founder at Reflow Hub, and you were previously at Ross & Zane, but I'd love to, you know, scale it back to the beginning. Could you, you know, introduce yourself to our listeners and maybe like give them some insight on your background before you got into startups?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I graduated with a bachelor's in economics, but, you know, whilst I was studying, I was actually full-time at JP Morgan for 2 years. And this was around that GFC time. You know, around that time, I decided to leave and start a business called Merida, which was really a placeholder name just to run different, you know, startup ideas through. And through a few different iterations, yeah, I'm now at Reflow Hub.
Yeah, wow. That was a good summary. I'm just like, you know, surprised, taken aback. You said you worked at JP Morgan when you were a sophomore?
Yeah, so I was in second year uni, actually, when I got the confirmation. I had applied during my first year, you know, at uni for a number of jobs, actually, and without actually disclosing to the HR that I wasn't a graduate student, I actually made it through to the final round. And wow. Yeah, basically, at the final stages, they decided to give me a shot because I said, hey, I will not let my studies get in the way. And I think that really resonated with them, and the drive and commitment to working at the organization really, really sort of showed through. So yeah, they gave me a chance and I got a full-time job, and I was the youngest employee in Asia Pacific at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. Yeah, that's very, very impressive. And then you said you were at Merida. What was Merida?
So when I had left JP Morgan, I had really just wanted to just, you know, give the whole startup world a go. So I had gone back to full-time study after those 2 years at JP Morgan. And I initially started off with, you know, more sort of financy stuff, right? Because, you know, studying economics, working at, you know, JP Morgan, I thought, okay, well, maybe I could do some sort of loan facilitation. But through a number of iterations, I basically found a very niche business in inventory management that basically helps, you know, small, medium business liquidate inventory that is slow moving or is end of life that no longer is required in the market.
And then this is Reflow Hub today, right?
And through a number of discussions and just sort of like, you know, in that ecosystem, yeah, Reflow Hub was essentially born because Merida was really focusing on the wider consumer electronics group of brand new products. So, you know, I was working with the equivalents of like Walmart and whatnot in Australia. And we had started to see that, hey, there's some returns, you know, of mobile devices that were basically in perfect condition, but couldn't be resold as brand new. And as that business grew, I decided to spin it out into Reflow Hub and, you know, focus on the SaaS side of things, that marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. I'd love to just, you know, pull it back here and just like, I guess, find this, talk about more of this, you know, change that you made between like industry and startups. You know, you have like an impressive background in working in, you know, lots of finance stuff. And then when you were at Merida, you said you wanted to give the, you know, the startup stuff a try. I guess, you know, coming from someone who had like huge experience in industry, like being the youngest employee at JP Morgan, you know, when you were like in second year uni, I'm just curious, like, why did you make the change? You know, like, what about startups was so appealing for you to leave the full-time job?
So I guess around this, the story is a little conventional. You know, I'm of Chinese heritage. You know, I was born and raised in Australia, but my parents are immigrants. And yeah, both sides of the family are quite entrepreneurial. But as with many immigrant families, they want their children to be a lawyer, be a doctor, you know. So I went down that route and yeah, essentially, you know, suit and tie and go into a corporate environment, which they were very happy with. But because I was so young, you know, at 18 years old working at JP Morgan, you just don't really have a point of reference. So I was working really long hours, still trying to study, still trying to maintain a social life. And I think just doing those 2 years, like during the GFC, was like an eye-opener. I was like, am I going to be really doing this until retirement? And, you know, the entrepreneurial, you know, the startup space was really sort of blowing up, you know, with Facebook and, you know, Instagram, I mean, which was nothing like what it is today, was blowing up. And I thought, okay, like, whilst I'm still studying, why not give it a go, right? I mean, it could be a little blip in my resume if I need to go back into the corporate world. And so, yeah, I mean, I started Merida just as a vehicle to test out different ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. I can definitely, you know, resonate with the, you know, Asian parents want you to be like a doctor, a lawyer. But yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for, you know, being vulnerable and sharing. And I love to just like go into it. You know, Ross and Zane was like your first startup, right? How did that, you know, fit into your whole journey into, you know, reselling consumer electronics?
So at Ross and Zane, I mean, it really came from just sort of watching the startup space. And, you know, just at the time, I think, you know, the Valley was really focusing on just sort of like pouring their funds into a number of food startups, like Munchery, Sprig, Spoon Rocket, I mean, Blue Apron. And they were all very similar in their own way, but we had kind of a slightly different spin. And yeah, we just wanted to really give it a go. And I think typically, the food business, whether it be like a cafe or like a traditional restaurant, is typically what a lot of consumers sort of think of when starting a small business. But we thought, hey, like, is there a play here where we can sort of add a bit of, you know, innovation and, you know, quote unquote disruption to that space? So that's where like Ross and Zane was really born from.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess I'm just curious, where did this, you know, fall into play? Was this when you're at Merida? Or like, yeah, how long did Ross and Zane live, you know, and when did you start it?
So Merida was, again, like the first business vehicle or company that I created to run different ideas from. And the inventory management business really, through different iterations, really stuck. And it's been running for like, you know, 10 years since. And during that time was when I started to gain a little bit of traction, a little bit of success, you know, running my own business. And that's when I sort of started to have a wandering eye, so to speak. You know, I had friends who were in my same cohort that was starting to, you know, also get sick of that corporate life. And we would have conversations and yeah, it really came, you know, in between that time at Merida.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I love to play this game with founders, but if you had to describe, you know, Ross and Zane to like a 10-year-old, what would you say that Ross and Zane did?
Ross and Zane is a forever changing menu that does lunch deliveries Monday to Friday on a subscription basis.
Nice. Pretty good. And I guess I'm just curious here, you know, this was out of, I'm assuming Ross and Zane was built out of like Sydney, Australia?
Yes. So I had an office in Sydney here for Merida and we would just basically, you know, give a couple of tables to the team.
Sure, sure. And, you know, I'm just about, you know, Ross and Zane in particular, like what was the, you know, problem that you're trying to solve? Like I don't, you know, from a foreigner who has like been to Sydney, Australia like one time in my life when I was like maybe 6 or 7, I guess, you know, like I don't think about it as like something of like where startups are built. So I'd love to, you know, just like get your thoughts on like the ecosystem and like why you felt the need to build this food delivery startup in the ecosystem.
Yeah, I guess to lay the background here, this is pre Uber Eats, pre Deliveroo and Postmates and all those other delivery services. In Sydney in particular, I mean, we're a very small city in the way that we have 4 million people. I mean, like as a population, we have 24 million people and we have a lot of land. We're quite spread out. And pre all this, you know, all the delivery trends now, you're pretty much as a office worker, pretty much limited to restaurants and cafes that were close by to you. And in Sydney, a lot of those cafes and restaurants actually use a small group of food, wholesalers. So all the food, the wraps and sandwiches are actually very, very similar, which is, you know, really bad for the consumer, but really good for like the incumbents. So for us, like when I had worked at, you know, in the bank, I was pretty much, you know, tied down to like a 30, 45 minute lunch. And I would basically be going to the same four or five cafe restaurants and picking up a sandwich. So for us, like we really used that empathy and went, okay, well, how do we sort of solve this problem of number one, getting more control over time? Everyone is having lunch around the same time. So how do we give them more flexibility with eating earlier or eating later? Because a lot of places, you know, basically close after 2 o'clock. You know, if you're stuck in a meeting, you basically got to get your food early or you don't eat for the day. And the second was really just to get variety. I mean, in Sydney, like we have an Anglo-Saxon culture and the food is by and large quite homogenous. So we wanted to sort of bring some creative flair so that it's you're eating lunch Monday to Friday, you know, at the office. So we wanted to bring just that variety.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I guess I'm more curious about like the, you know, the lay of the land, like you say, but, you know, the media today portrays a lot of, you know, Silicon Valley, lots of Bay Area startups, you know, they're talking about like LA more, they're talking about New York, but they never talk about like anything like kind of outside the United States bubble, if you will. So I'm just curious, you know, like being like a repeat founder, like a first time founder, like what was it like founding a company in like Australia?
Hard. Totally hard. I mean, there just isn't that ecosystem, right? I mean, you know, in the Valley, even in New York these days, right? I mean, they have a very developed and mature ecosystem for startups. I mean, the energy from like all the Americans I meet who are sort of, you know, involved in this space, they're all optimistic. I mean, they have their own thoughts about like whether a startup will succeed or not, but they're always very gung-ho. And I think it's a very different mentality to, you know, the Sydney space. It's number one, smaller, but also just they don't take those moonshots. If they go, oh, okay, look, you know, the chances of success is like 2%, they'll see it as 2%. They won't see, oh, wow, that's like, there is potential there, you know? So I guess in that sense, they're a little bit more risk adverse.
Sure, sure. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing. And, you know, I'd love to just like contextualize or like just go into Ross and Zane here. So from what I'm hearing, you probably had like a team of chefs too. You didn't partner with like these big brands to just like deliver their food, but rather you had, you know, people cooking the food and then corporate people or people who are like your users could pick them up from locations, if I'm correct.
So the chef team size was a size of one. We had one chef preparing all the meals, doing all the produce buying, and he would have, you know, like a small team of, you know, on-demand staff who would come in on a part-time basis to help prep up with some of the food. But yeah, essentially it was a one-man show on that kitchen front. And we actually operated out of, you know, it wasn't called a cloud kitchen back in those days, but I mean, now it pretty much is quite developed. We worked out of a remote kitchen in the city and we had delivered from that location, from a central location into that central business district. So we would deliver straight to the customer.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you also have like a team of deliverers doing this? Like, did you put in like a some central location or would you like, you know, deliver, you know, to the last mile of the customers, like wherever they work?
Yeah, we would do the full end-to-end. So the last mile, it would be from the kitchen straight to, you know, the building, lobby, foyer.
Yeah, and then this was like pre-Uber Eats. So like if anything, you know, you laid the groundwork for them.
Oh, totally. I mean, those bags that they're using now, I mean, we had sourced those from China like way before.
Wow, wow. Yeah, so, you know, I'd love to talk more so here about like, you know, I'm very, very surprised here that like, you know, the one-man show, because the one thing that struck me about Ross and Zane was the like really, really quality food. Like I was reading, you know, some of the old food like entries and you have things like kimchi burger and sweet potato fries. You have garlic butter prawn pasta. You have Thai beef salad with vermicelli noodles, you know, etc. I guess like what I'm getting at here is like it was all the chef, but like how did you guys, you know, like source the menu? And like it seems like all very, very Asian inspired. So I'd love to just like, you know, talk about that because I know you were talking about how lots of the food options, you know, around corporate people, like they were all kind of like wholesale or like very, very sourced from like one location. So I'd love if you could talk about, you know, like developing the menu, like what you guys thought about like being out there first and like what was the feedback on your food?
Mm. So with the sort of cuisine, yes, it is very, you know, Asian inspired. That was intentional just because on a number of levels, the first being, I think with Asian food, it's so generic, right? But there's so many different, you know, like there's, you know, Chinese, Korean, Filipino, Japanese, there's just Thai. And there's a lot of variety with Asian food. And it's very colorful. Like we wanted all the food to just look amazing. as opposed to like, you know, like a sandwich or like a typical salad that comes out. We wanted something just like with lots of color, green, red, all sorts, just to sort of brighten up the day of our customers. Like, because lunch is, you know, generally that small window where they have their own alone time. Yeah, we wanted them to have good food.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm just curious, considering like, you know, you wanted them to have good food, like, did this affect like your margins a lot? Because I assumed if your chef was, you know, buying like quality ingredients. Yeah, I'm just curious.
With the margins, not so much actually, because a lot of Asian dishes do have a lot of overlap. So you're still, you know, you're buying this sort of very similar, you know, garlic, all the sort of, you know, herbs and spices. So not in that regard. It does require more prep work because you are using more herbs and spices, but it wasn't anything that was difficult at our scale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's great. And, you know, I'd love to just like, you know, take this chronologically, but like, you know, you started Ross and Zane and like, it seems like, how was like adoption, you know, like at your peak, what would you say, like, you know, how many like users did Ross and Zane have? How many people were ordering food? And like, I'm just more also curious about like how your chef like ended up like cooking all these meals.
Yep. So, I mean, we basically started off with a pilot where we hadn't had the website or anything up yet, but we're just basically testing the packages. So we had basically these origami packages made out of China that would basically give us different configurations within the food delivery box. So typically, you know, like the typical one is like you just get like a bucket, right? We had different compartments, so we could have like a bento style. We could just have one large one, wow, or we could have, yeah, wow, you know, four smaller ones, depending on obviously what the customer chose on the menu. And yeah, basically we wanted to test that out. It was like, you know, all waterproof and whatnot. And there were vents to let, you know, heat and steam out so the food doesn't get soggy. So we're really sort of testing, number one, do the flavors keep? Number two, will it still be warm if we deliver within our radius? So because we were already operating out of that centralized kitchen, we were just delivering it to, you know, friends and family that were in the area just to see if, you know, number one, the timing worked, like, you know, from a user experience perspective, what went wrong. And yeah, basically overall, how the food kept, because that's like number one, right? I mean, if the food looks good online, but doesn't look the same or taste what you expect, then, you know, that's a major problem.
And then, you know, so I assume like after the pilot, how hard was it to, you know, attract customers to Ross and Zane?
So attracting hits was, I wouldn't say very easy, but because we had some news coverage, we had a couple of like kind of boutique places, as well as some like, you know, like larger news outlets that covered us, because this was a pretty novel idea at the time. So we're seeing, you know, like we're seeing hits of like 10,000 on the page. In terms of the conversion, I have to say, I was a little disappointed with the conversion rate. I mean, like, they were very tiny. We had huge churn as well. So people would try it out for that, you know, 1 week or 2 weeks. But inevitably, once they canceled, they weren't really coming back. So it was tough from that point of view. So in terms of the traction and the stickiness, yeah, that was probably the major challenge. Getting eyeballs and attention wasn't so much, just given that sort of the lay of the land at the time where there was no real competitor to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like you say, it was a very nascent idea. It was very, very new. I'm just curious, you know, you say you have like at like 1 to 2 week churn. Did you ever, you know, get customer feedback on like why they were churning?
One major one was the price. So we would send out weekly surveys at the end of the week. We used Typeform at the time, just with trying to get a gauge of, you know, how was the food quality? How was, you know, the delivery time? How was the ordering? A lot of people actually changed their choices through the week, which we were pretty surprised with, to be honest, because with the subscription model, we allowed the customer to essentially pick out all their lunches for the week and all the times they wanted delivered. We had expected them not to change just because people are creatures of habit. And we thought they'd be eating at a very similar time. But yeah, we were surprised that there were lots of changes, like with not just the food choice. Maybe they had a change of mind of what they wanted for the day, given the weather. And also the time. We delivered in 20-minute increment blocks. And obviously meetings go over time. And that's what we found out, that, you know, we had delivery people waiting for them and couldn't get in contact with them because they were in a meeting.
Yeah, yeah. And I assume like, you know, the delivery people just like ended up waiting. And, you know, that leads to like customers not being happy that their food is hot. But like, even though it was like their meeting that went overboard, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I don't want to like pry here, but like, I'd love to just dig deep into, I guess, the problems that you saw with like Ross and Zane. And like, I guess, you know, if you could tell a story, like, what was the like instantaneous moment where you knew, oh, Ross and Zane, or like this was going to be like too tough to like keep going and like maybe we have to shut it down?
Yeah, so I distinctly remember the moment. We had gained enough traction to really question do we kill this now or do we take it to the next level? And that moment was precisely where in my office, we have a lobby. And at the time, we had converted it into basically a storage facility full of fridges. Like I'm talking like five fridges and freezers and whatnot. And it was all full. And we were thinking, okay, we're servicing like 30, 40 people here, right? This is not even at numbers that what I worked on a financial model, those numbers were like tiny compared to what we needed to really, you know, get to scale, get to profitability and sustainability. I was like, this is nowhere near those numbers. And just physically being in that space and seeing how much produce we had, and then having a look at the reports of when we purchased the product and how long they would theoretically last for, I was like, we need a much, much bigger space. And I think that just threw me off. Given the margins, given the churn rate and the storage that we would need, I was like, look, there is potential here, but not for guys like us, not for like, you know, small operators. Like this idea could be executed by, you know, the large conglomerates, the incumbents who have the infrastructure, who have the manpower, who can, you know, really trade off the large investment required for the very little margin at the end of the tunnel. So for us, yeah, it just wasn't scalable.
Mm-hmm. And then that was like when you like ended up making the like the fateful decision to like shut it down?
Correct. Yeah. You know, we had talked about it and we were just saying, okay, like where's our funding at? And how much would we predict that we would need in order to take the business to the next level? We weren't seeing enough traction and stickiness on the subscription side to really justify taking that chance though. I mean, if we had very low churn, I think it would have been a different story, but yeah, just with all the metrics that we're seeing, we're like, hey, like this is still a super risky venture to take on with a bigger commitment.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Thank you for being vulnerable. And I guess I'd love to just, you know, get your more like status quo or like more meta thoughts about like the food space as a whole for someone, you know, who started a venture in it like pretty early. So, you know, I think like the movement today is like on like last mile delivery, like people really need to still solve that. And then they're trying to like, you know, pivot into like pickups, like Snack Pass, you know, Uber Eats also has like a new pickup service. And I would say like there's a lot of like comparisons to Ross and Zane today. Like I don't know if you're familiar with like Forkable, but like they also do like, you know, delivery services for like businesses. I guess, you know, what are your thoughts today? Like I know a lot of people think that like putting money into food space is just like, you know, making negative 100x returns because like all that does is like hemorrhage money. But I'm just curious at like, you know, what you're thinking like as of now about the food space.
So with the food business, I mean, traditionally it's always been tough. Right. The margins are very tricky. You need to be a really good operator because you're dealing with perishables. Your inputs are perishables, right? They go off. So you need to be able to manage your consumables. And how do you manage your consumables? You basically need to know your numbers. You need to know your regular customers that are coming through, your baseline numbers. So the food business has always been really, really tough. As I mentioned like earlier, right? Like with some of the companies like Munchery and Sprig, I mean, they've gone out of business. And these were like, you know, they were backed by, you know, some of the best and the smartest in the Valley, right? Who could give them, you know, marketing advice, who could give them connections, you know, in the space. And they ended up going down as well. And I think it's because it's fundamentally the technology / innovation, the increment is just too small, right? I mean, for consumers, right? Consumers are very, very price sensitive in the food space because it is so saturated. So yes, your delivery mechanism may be different, but essentially you're still getting food. You're still getting something that you're going to eat. Right. And for someone like who's going to be having lunch, who's expecting a $10 meal, they're not going to pay $15 unless it's for some reason 10 times better. That's just not going to happen in the food space. So I think like with those sort of economics and those realities, I think the food business will continue to be really, really tough. And just because like that physical component is still there. I mean, it's not like SaaS where you have very low marginal costs, you know, because you have one code base and you can scale ship code. You're still working with that offline space. I mean, you still need to have, you know, people delivering food, you know, whether it rains or whether it's sunny. So I think a lot of those physical sort of parameters really do dictate like you're basically your cost and eventually your bottom line.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm just curious, you know, as someone, you know, you're working on Reflow Hub right now, and like someone who's kind of like distanced themselves from the food space, if you will, I'm just curious, you know, from like a third person perspective now, would you say, you know, the problem that you guys were solving with Ross and Zane, you know, in either Australia or like anywhere like in the food space, like, would you say like it's been solved?
To a certain degree, yes. You know, with the advent of Uber Eats, they're just everywhere. They're ubiquitous, right? They're all on the road everywhere, whether they're on a scooter or on a bicycle. I've seen a guy who was delivering Uber Eats, you know, walking.
I would safely
say that in terms of getting your meal, yes. In terms of variety, yes, to a degree. But, you know, with the rise of, you know, these, I think it's called like shadow kitchens.
Yeah, like ghost virtual.
Yeah, ghost kitchens. Yeah, you know, they're running, you know, 2-3 different restaurants, you know, basically from the one kitchen, right? I mean, so if they're like within your vicinity, you're getting variety as well. So I would say to a large degree, like, yeah, I think this market might have been solved.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, like to the extent of like, I know ghost kitchens is like, kind of like it holds like a special place in my heart because like it was founded in like my hometown in California. So like we knew the founder, but yeah, I was like talking to him like recently about like the numbers, and like he would say it could be like up to like 19 or like 20 restaurants under one location.
Yeah, so that's scale, right? Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, and you know, if like they end up getting like bigger and bigger locations, like, you know, the number of restaurants that you can like fit in over there with like the overlap of like ingredients and stuff, I can't even imagine, you know, like you could just run like 200 locations of Uber Eats under one roof.
Yeah. So, I mean, in that situation, right, I mean, if they're able to solve the physical limitations, right, then it's really about focusing on the other metrics like reviews and, you know, food photo quality. And because it's just you're ordering virtually, right? I mean, you're not going to the restaurant, you're not driving by the restaurant. So it lives purely in that virtual space.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, and then I'd love to just like, you know, take it chronologically again, but how did you go from Ross and Zane into, I'm assuming Reflow Hub, into your next project?
Yep. So Marito and Reflow Hub are linked in the sense that Reflow Hub was really born from Marito. At Marito, we focus on liquidating consumer electronics that are brand new, again, on the wholesale level. So with the large distributors and retailers, we essentially provide that service that helps them liquidate, you know, models that are redundant or just slow moving, right? And that's just their capital locked up into inventory that's not moving at all. So we'll help them liquidate at a discount rate. And again, I sort of touched on it briefly, but we would typically see a lot of vendors approaching us and saying, you know, hey, we've got like all these returns, you know, after Black Friday sales or after Christmas, you know, these were change of minds or they were gifts that were unwanted. They've been open, but essentially they're virtually new. You know, could you take these? And we started to sort of like look at it and assess the market because they were virtually brand new, but the packaging was maybe, you know, open or was not even, you know, existent. We saw that there was still appetite. Typically in, you know, like the, you know, developing markets, right? Or, you know, very price sensitive markets. So Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines, just because of proximity, like because we're in Asia Pacific, we found that there was a market for these sort of, you know, high-end brands. And as that division grew larger and larger, just the operation started to get a little bit more messy and required a little bit more work because there's a lot of different spreadsheets, a lot of different SKU codes and whatnot. We thought, okay, like if we have the parameters locked down, let's try to connect our vendors directly with our buyers through a marketplace. And that's when Reflow Hub was really born. So we wanted inventory to flow through internationally, but we added the re just because we wanted to add that reuse, recycle vibe to it. So we had spun out the business into a new entity and we wanted to really sort of focus on providing that marketplace, that software layer. But, you know, like we typically with a lot of marketplaces, there's a lot of challenges, things like trust. So who did the vendors know and who did the buyers know and trust? It was us, the broker, the middle person. Who do they want to cut out? The middle person. So we needed to add a lot of value, right? And we're a managed marketplace. That's the way we like to sort of frame ourselves. And essentially, just to sort of touch on that real quick, it's like Uber, right? I mean, if you lose your sunglasses in a ride, you don't reach out directly to the driver. You reach out to Uber. Uber will facilitate that. When you make a payment using your credit card, Uber's facilitating that payment. Right. Maybe there's a timing difference. Maybe there isn't. But that's what essentially the sort of role we're playing is we're really facilitating that transaction between the vendors and the buyers. We handle the shipments. We handle the payments. We handle all the anti-money laundering, you know your customer compliance.
Yeah. I'm assuming like with like some lull in time, this was like after Ross and Zane. I guess I'm curious, like moving to like from food delivery into like consumer electronics, right? Are there any, you know, like tangible lessons that you brought over from Ross and Zane into like, you know, your next company at Reflow Hub?
I think there were some similarities in the sense that there was still an operational component because it was offline. So I think the sort of industry lingo here is like O2O, like, online to offline. I mean, it's like Uber, right? The transaction takes place online where you order the ride, or in this case, you strike a deal to offload inventory. But the execution takes place offline, right? Where we need to ship the product. And that comes with a whole bunch of things, right? Like with export compliance, trade documentation, and facilitating payment, insurance on the shipment. We're typically dealing with pallets. So what we kind of learned from Ross and Zane was really, okay, there is still a operational component here. We need to be, on it in terms of just managing a really tight ship with process-driven procedures. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, that's a good segue into my next question, but this is like sort of like a meta thing, but like, we got you on the podcast because you were talking with Rich about, your challenges about like Reflow Hub and like related to like balancing product development and like commercial agreement, So I'd love to just like talk about like how you guys are growing now, like what challenges you guys are facing, and like anything like you can share about Reflow Hub to like contextualize more, like even though, you guys like did huge merchandise volume, and I assume like you're of a business of that size, you're making like some sort of returns, but I love to just, contextualize like any challenges that like Reflow Hub is facing right now.
Yeah. So again, like, as you mentioned, like last financial year, we did see, sizable gross merchandise value. Can't get into the actual bottom line, but we are profitable. Sure, so that's something for us that's, just puts a smile on all our faces, right? Because we have no burn rate. But herein lies the problem is because we don't have a burn rate because we're profitable, balancing product development is tricky. Our commercial agreements that we work on the vendor side and on the buyer side, they're typically really, really long cycles. No matter how excited, our champion is on the vendor side, because they're multinational typically, there's a lot of regulatory red tape internally. You need to align a lot of your stakeholders at the vendor side to get agreements done. Legal reviews and compliance are two words that they've been etched into my brain, right? They do vettings after vettings, and it's just a super long cycle. So I think balancing how quickly we need to develop the product and how pretty we need to make it, to kind of make sure that the vendors, they're okay with. Because even though it's a B2B software, vendors still want to see some professionalism, right? It's not just purely product market fit. So it's a bit tricky trying to balance, those two elements.
Yeah, sure. And, that's like, I love to touch on that a little bit. You said like how pretty we have to make the product, right? I'm just curious, like these are like returned phones or like people that like they have the change of mind and like they don't want to buy it. How are you, reselling these phones? Like, what are you checking for? And like, how do you market these as like something that's like close to, a new product, even though it isn't?
Yeah, yeah. So one of the trends that we've been able to ride is the increase in the average selling price of these mobile devices. I mean, you look at an iPhone, it's like 1,500 like USD, right? And the latest Samsung phones, they're expensive,
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So when we're working with like the vendors, and they're basically at the moment, they're on a tear to retain customers, right? Like I think the last 20 years, it's been on acquisition. But now that everyone has a mobile phone, it's about keeping their customer base, right? Like you've got, AT&T, T-Mobile, Sprint, all these guys are trying to keep their customer base, not necessarily grow it. So in terms of like retention, they need value add. They need to be like, okay, hey, like how do we get Brandon into a T-Mobile store and get him to re-sign up on a contract for the latest iPhone or the latest Samsung phone, right? Because at those prices, it's pretty hard to fork out that sort of money. So we need to give him some sort of payment plan for it. So how can we kind of offset that? Hey, Brandon, do you have an existing device, which you probably do? We're going to give you great value and trade that in. And we'll price it based on the condition. And why that matters is because on the buy side, right, that we work with, we typically work with repair centers, refurbishers. And if they're in pretty good condition, we'll work with like wholesalers who simply remarket A-grade devices into their retail channels. Typically like, Europe, North America, there's quite a healthy, secondary market for mobile phones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, I'm just curious, like, it seems like you guys are like doing well. You're profitable. There's like returns that's like put a smile on your face, and you have like this great customer acquisition strategy. I don't mean to have like the Fillory podcast be something that like you look back on and be like, oh, what did I say for that answer? But like, what is your 10x future here for Reflow Hub? Like, pardon me if I'm like, a little undereducated here, but it seems a little bit stagnant in that all you seem to do, you know, year on, year in, you know, you're selling the new model of like device, or you're selling like this other new model of device. I guess, you know, what are things you can do to like innovate? Or like, I'm just like lingering on that question, you know, like what's the 10x feature here for Reflow Hub?
So to answer that question, I need to give you a little bit of background.
Yeah, sure.
The interaction that we have with the vendor, it's for them a back office activity in the sense that their primary objective is to retain their customer base on the retail side, right? You as a consumer, me as a consumer. So when they aggregate large volumes of mobile devices of different spec, of different grade in their warehouse, they need to close off that loop because essentially they're giving you money to purchase your used device. They need to now liquidate that. And because they have, you know, a buildup of such large volume, typically, you know, 1,000 to 10,000, they need to liquidate that periodically. Now, their go-to-market strategy is a spreadsheet. And with that many attributes and SKUs, it's very difficult to accurately and competitively price. So what we do is we take that spreadsheet and we basically have that go through a mapping feature on the platform, and that just aggregates all the numbers for different SKUs, for different grades. This allows the buy side to essentially price it up on a SKU level basis that just takes the pain away. Like, again, you have to remember, for the vendors, they just need this done. It's the cost center for them, right? It's not revenue generating. So because it takes away so much of their pain, they're very happy to just like, okay, hey, how do we use this? How do we get on board? But they need to do their vetting checks on us. So I guess the kind of 10x feature here is adding simplicity into their backend operations.
Yeah. And, you know, I hope this isn't like, you know, like sounds the same, but like, what's the 10x future? Like, what are your goals here for Reflow Hub?
So we want to expand not just the actual transactional nature, like a marketplace like eBay, Amazon, but we want to get like deeper. We want to get like further into the supply chain. So we want to get closer to the consumers. We want to run like the financing. So when you walk, you know, into a Sprint T-Mobile store, rather than T-Mobile financing it, we want to be able to do that because we have the data. We have the market prices with how a particular iPhone model is tracking on a price basis, how much fluctuation there is, how much supply there is in the market, at what particular grade. We want to basically give the consumer real-time value on how much their device is worth. As you know, right, a mobile phone is going to price degrade over time, right? As time goes on, your prices is just going to keep dropping. So we want to basically have a call to action for the consumer, is they can see that their price is dropping on a weekly basis or whatever, and try to encourage them to get into the store and trade it in. And in exchange for that, we want the vendors to utilize our software on that real-time basis. And that's what we're really sort of envisioning, right? Essentially, we want to run an ecosystem for the reuse and recirculation of mobile devices on that global level.
Yeah, absolutely. I love, you know, if I went into like a T-Mobile store and they were talking about, oh yeah, like there's like a picture of like you guys on Reflow Hub, or like your picture on like a T-Mobile store. Be like, oh yeah, I know this guy. But yeah, so, you know, juxtaposing, you know, two startups, like, or two companies here, I guess, you know, I'm just curious, like moving from a low conversion, low engagement company with like high churn at like Ross and Zane to like, you know, tapping into like the potential market of like hundreds of millions of people who like purchase a phone every year in like Reflow Hub. I guess, what are your thoughts here as like a, you know, founder, or like, yeah, playing like a high level position and like going from a company who like had low engagement towards like going to a company who had like, you know, hundreds of millions of engagement?
I think for me, the real contrast here is bandwidth, right? We're a small team. So the ability for us to focus on what does our user or what does our customer look like is probably the biggest defining factor. At Ross and Zane, I mean, yes, we had the typical consumer that we would envision, right? Office worker, works in the city, wants variety in their food. But essentially, they're still individual people. It's very hard to cater to all the different tastes and nuances that they might have. Whereas on a B2B level, it's a lot simpler in that way because you're essentially dealing with concentration. Like each user, each business that gets on board onto the platform will bring in, you know, a customer like an LTV, right? The lifetime value of much greater proportions than a single customer who will want to try different, you know, options in a saturated market. So I think that's probably like the biggest, is being able to just naturally balance your bandwidth and your energy in terms of who you're focusing on and who you're building the product for is probably the biggest takeaway for us between the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, I love the, you touched on it a little bit, but like the small comparison you made between like consumer products, whether that be food and like phones, you know, I don't think people like have like too much preference of like what phone that they're getting like that day versus food.
Exactly right.
But yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Terrence. Like, I love your answers. I just want to move into, you know, this is like kind of like a tradition now on the podcast, but you know, if Terrence right now, right, had to talk to like Terrence, you know, circa Ross and Zane, you know, shutting down, like you remember that moment. And like, if you had to talk to him, right, and you know, whether this be like, you know, like you talking to like any founder out there who's like in the trenches right now, and you know, whether it be going well or going, you know, poorly, what would you say to like Terrence, you know, circa like Ross and Zane shutting down?
Everything's gonna be okay. Look after yourself. That's the best thing you can do. I mean, you know, whenever you fly, it says, hey, look after yourself before you look after anyone. That is 100% true as a founder. I mean, it's super lonely, right? I mean, it's tough because like the chances and the odds are really against you. And that's fine. I mean, those are risks that you're willing to take. So just keep in mind that everyone is going to doubt you. Everyone's going to, you know, poke holes at it. And you got to take it with a grain of salt, but you also got to listen to them sometimes, right? Because them preemptively telling you those things, they're really helping you go through training exercise. But yeah, my key point would be keep yourself healthy, like mentally, physically, spiritually, right? Like look up, you know, mindfulness, take breaks. Like people just want to work, 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 but that's going to give them negative yield on that. We're not machines, unfortunately. You know, we need to take a break and just rebalance. And physical health really translates to, you know, your mental health as well and your ability to focus on what you're doing and not be so wired and anxious all the time, you know? So yeah, look after yourself.
Yeah, wow. A lot of that was very, very personal to me. So like, I kind of had a moment there. But this is like your moment if you want to plug anything. Where can our listeners find you, you know, on the internet, on like Twitter, on LinkedIn? You know, quick plug Reflow Hub. Is it a .com?
It is a .com.
Yeah, ReflowHub.com.
I believe we're on all those platforms, but just because like, you know, we have such a small team and like we're so focused on, you know, serving our users who are like, you know, on that enterprise business front. We are really slacking off on the content, you know, on the social media side of things. But yeah, I mean, I'm on Twitter. You know, I'm super open to, you know, obviously like, you know, supporting and talking to founders and whatnot. So my handle is like Terrence Tam AU on Twitter.
Yeah. You know, if any of our listeners are, you know, thinking about turning your like office lobby into like a hub for refrigerators, please, please don't, you know, like reach out to Terrence. Like, absolutely.
Yeah. I'll give you insights on that.
Absolutely. Terrence, thank you so much, you know, for taking the time to be on the Failure Podcast. I had a great, great time. I hope you did too.
It's been awesome. Thank you so much, Brandon. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And that was another episode of the Failure Podcast. You know, we have a bunch of these coming out soon, so please stick around and thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Failery Podcast. I've been Brandon Hendoko, and once more, I'd like to thank our friends over at Referral Hero for making this podcast episode possible. If you're looking to grow your business organically through word of mouth, make sure to check out their tool that'll allow you to create and grow a referral program within minutes. More than 7,000 companies are using it already, generating over 30 million leads, and now you can get it too for 20% off with the code FAILERY20. Try it now for 14 days without any cost at referralhero.com.